I think we are about ready to begin. I don't know if the bell has rung or not, but it's about 9 o'clock. My name is Wesley Granberg Michelson, and I'll be doing the Bible study with you this morning as well as Tuesday and Wednesday morning. I'm from Missoula, Montana. This session I've titled In the Image of God. All three sessions are really dealing with what we can call the theology of creation. Although if some of you are leaving tomorrow, you don't have to be too concerned, because each one of the sessions will stand on its own. But for those who are with us for the whole week, if you come all three mornings, you'll find that they do sort of relate to one another. And I see some familiar faces who were with us on Saturday night when we had a very lively session called Redeeming the Earth. And in many ways, that session sort of sets the groundwork for the more serious Bible study, which we're going to be doing this morning and the next two mornings as well. So with that introduction, I want to give, for those of you who weren't with us, a very brief summary of why we are looking at what we call the theology of creation in the first place. And for the sake of the taping people who I just noticed rushed in the door, I'm going to repeat my name and the title, since, as you know, all these things are taped. It's okay. All right, fine. We already have it. Now, we said on Saturday evening that in the Hebrew language, there's no word for what we say when we say nature. When we say nature, particularly when we're here at Holden Village, and we think of this sort of realm of life, of rocks and trees and mountains and sky, scenery, those things that are out apart from ourselves. We go to nature. We go on a nature hike. We have nature hikes here. We treat nature as something we retreat to and come back from, something that is apart from us. We can go to it and we could return, but it's out there apart from us, and it sort of exists more or less on its own, has its own sort of laws and regulations and rules. And in our culture at large, over the past 300-400 years, because of the growth of the scientific method and lots of things of that sort, we've come to regard nature as something autonomous, something that exists in and of itself. I mean, that's the way virtually any scientist, for practical purposes, has to relate to nature, and it's the way that most of our culture has come to relate to nature. We can say in this way that nature is secularized, meaning we regard it as though it exists on its own apart from God. That's the meaning of the word secular. Something has its existence and its identity in and of itself without any relationship to God. That's the way our culture has come to regard nature. And at one level, and we tried a little experiment on Saturday night and to sort of see what came to our minds when we said nature, I think at one level a lot of us, that's just naturally the way we think about nature. We've grown up thinking that way. What we've discovered is that that's a profoundly unbiblical way of approaching the whole subject. Because in the mind of the Bible, there is such a profound sense that all of what we call nature, or what we might better call creation, because that's really a more theological word, all of what we call creation exists only because of God, and not just that God created it at one point and then set it out and let it go its merry way. Not at all. Its life, day by day, moment to moment, exists only because God sustains it. The image of the world as a clock, invented by a clockmaker, which starts its ticking, you know, winds it up, and starts itself ticking, and then sets it off, and then it just sort of goes on, and people eventually figure out how to open the door and get inside and discover how it works, which is the way people like Francis Bacon and Isaac Newton and René Descartes and many other famous philosophers and scientists, it's sort of the image that they had. It may have been a helpful image in their time, but it's profoundly unbiblical. There's no sense of that at all in the Bible, of creation as though it's kind of made by God and then kicked out the door, you know. You read the Psalms, for instance. Many of the Psalms, we referred to Psalm 104 as just one example. Psalms which are also written to give a picture of creation. And the picture they give is of a life that is sustained constantly by God. You know the verse, all creatures look to thee and thou givest them thy fruit in good season. There's been choir anthems written on it, and you've probably all recited that or sung that. It's part of that great 104th Psalm, which is this picture of God sustaining life every moment. There is a theologian I have come to regard, his name is Paulus Gregorius. He's from India. Fine Christian and a very provocative thinker. He has said, the concept of nature as the non-human part of the universe. Nature as the non-human part of the universe. And that's sort of the way a lot of people in our culture at least exist. Is primarily Indo-Hellenic. That just means it comes from Greece and maybe somewhat from Indian culture. I mean, in India meaning the country. In origin, and becomes particularly prominent in an alienated society. That is, one which has lost its direct sense of dependence on and derivation from God. So if you take any society, it can be our society or it could be any other, that basically doesn't think much as a whole about how it has been derived from and depends upon God, if it's a society that has become secularized, then it's going to be expected that its view of nature will also be secularized. All right? Now, H. Wheeler Robinson, person wrote a book called Inspiration and Revelation in the Old Testament. Sort of a classic, been referred to many times since by various biblical scholars and pastors and so forth. Some of you who have pastors might have read it in seminaries, published about 1948. He says this in trying to get at the picture of what we call nature in the Old Testament. He says, nature is alive through and through, and therefore the more capable of sympathy with humanity and of response to the rule of its creator and upholder on whom it directly depends. It's alive through and through, capable of sympathy, relationship with us. In other words, we have a relationship with creation. I mean, of course we do. We can't live without it. We exist in this relationship, and it responds to the rule of its creator and upholder on whom it directly depends. That's more of where the Old Testament is coming from. Those of you who have heard John Schramm, the director here at Holden, do Bible studies, he talks about think-withs when he does Bible studies. Maybe some of you have been here before. Well, in the Old Testament, this is the think-with, okay? That goes along with how the Old Testament understands these subjects. This is where the Bible begins from. Now, when we think about creation and creation theology and these subjects, what parts of the Bible come to mind? Anyone?
Genesis.
A chorus. Genesis. All right. Now, what chapters of Genesis?
One.
One, two, three. All right. My friends, that's part of our problem. Here on the board, these are just a few examples of the places in the scripture which talk specifically about creation, both about God's activity in creating the world and about humanity's relationship to the world of creation. We're not going to go through all of them, but I just want to put them on the board to show you how the points where the Bible is rich and full. I'll read them off for you if you can't all see them, and for the benefit of the tape. Psalms, the 8th, the 19th, the 74th, the 104th. Now, this is neglecting those Psalms, manifold, where images and where the subject of the natural world is prominent within them. But these are Psalms that specifically talk about the world of creation, about God's act of creation. Psalm 104 was written as a creation psalm. Just like Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 and Psalm 104, this is another biblical picture of how the world came to be and how it lives its life. It was written for the children of Israel in order to explain that in the same way in which Genesis 1 and 2 were. In Proverbs, the 3rd chapter, verses 19 and 20, the 8th chapter, verses 22 to 31. In Job, a few days ago, I think it was at Vespers, there were portions quoted. Towards the end of the book of Job, there's a magnificent picture of creation in which God basically says, here you are in the created world, this is the creation. Now, who are you to think that you can discern my thoughts, my will, my ways? The chapters, 38 and 39 in particular, again, give a magnificent picture of the created world. In Jeremiah, a couple of verses stand out, 27:5 and 35:17. Then in Isaiah, there are magnificent passages about creation that tie creation to God's redemptive purposes, and that speak again about how God created and how he will also create a new people. They're in the latter half of Isaiah, where the themes of God's doing a new work are accentuated. Isaiah 40, verses 12 to 31. Isaiah 45, verses 9 to 13. Isaiah 48, verses 12 and 13. And then the New Testament. The New Testament as well is full of passages which speak to the same point. We normally don't think of this, but one that you certainly are all familiar with is John, first chapter of John, the prologue. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. The Word was God. Nothing was made which was made that did not come forth from the Word. One of the most profound passages about God's work in creation in the first five verses of John. In Hebrews 11:3, and in addition, the second chapter of Hebrews that I'm going to be referring to towards the end. Also, there's two or three verses in the first chapter, verses 3 through 5 in Hebrews. 1 Corinthians 8:6, which is probably a very old hymn of the church, which begins with a declaration about God being the maker of heaven and earth. I don't even have up here on the board the many times in Acts when various declarations made by the disciples also in the early church begin with specific reference to God as the maker, the creator. One of the most famous is that early time after the disciples are preaching and Peter and John, I think it is, get thrown in jail. They come out through a sort of deliverance, and they meet with the church, and the church recites a hymn, and the hymn begins with a statement about God the Creator and about God's work of creation. So we can assume that these themes were understood and regularly a part of the life of the earliest Christian community after Christ. Ephesians 1:10 plus other passages in Ephesians, and then very stirring passage in Colossians, the first chapter, particularly verses 15 through 17, a startling view of the cosmic purposes and cosmic reach of redemption and of Christ's presence in and intention for all the creation. So you see, the theme that we're dealing with is not just in Genesis 1 through 3, even though that is historically where the church has tended to devote most of its attention. I mean, after all, it's the first three chapters, right? It's the beginning of the Bible, so it must be must deal with the beginning. I suppose that's the way we've thought. They certainly are not the earliest scriptures written chronologically. In fact, it's pretty clear that Genesis 1 was probably written after Genesis 2 was written. Genesis 2 was probably written before Genesis 1. You go on through the old. So, in other words, it's not chronological. It just happens to be that's the way these scriptures were collected. They were put in this order. And that's, I think, one of the things that has caused us to focus specifically on those first three chapters. The other mistake we make, and we'll be dealing with that a little bit this morning, we deal with the first three chapters of Genesis, but then neglect chapters 4 through 9 and 10, which really complete the story. In the Genesis picture, the whole story of how creation came to be and what the relationship between God and creation was intended to be and what happened and what we should do now, that story begins in Genesis 1:1, but it doesn't stop until the end of the story of Noah. And the story of Noah in the ark has to be understood directly in relationship to the beginning story of creation in Genesis 1 through 3. Because in some ways, when we look at the story of Noah, it's almost as if God has to start over. Because things went downhill so fast. And in fact, you look at that further and you see many scriptures in the ninth chapter of Genesis that almost repeat scriptures in Genesis 1, 26 to 28, almost verbatim, but with a couple of important changes. So this is just to broaden our picture of what the scriptures have to say on this subject, and to get us to think about all those places. Nevertheless, we will start looking at the first chapter of Genesis. And in order to do that, I want to ask you what you think of, what comes to your mind, or what you think theologically is meant by the phrase, the image of God. Genesis 1:26, 28, humanity was created in God's image.
It's his spirit from his soul, the inner part.
I'm just going to write some of these things up here. Spirit or soul, okay? Spiritual, soul. Okay, this is image of God, what we think of. There's been a lot of theology about this, and I'm sure you've heard a lot of sermons. I you don't have to worry about whether you're right or wrong, okay? just tell me what you think of when you...
Resemblance.
Okay.
Character.
Excuse me?
Emotions. Character.
Proper relationship.
Without sin. Imprint.
Okay.
Ability to reason.
Creator.
Unending.
Creator.
Free will.
Unending. Free will.
inertia or energy?
Energy. It's an awful lot. You can see that there's been a lot of theology around this verse. Let me ask you something else. Where else in the scripture does it talk about humanity being created in the image of God? Any other passages come to mind?
Psalm 8.
Psalm 8. Very good. Psalm 8 is more or less a paraphrase in the first part of that psalm of Genesis 1, 26, 28. It's more or less taken right from there, but depending upon your translation, a few words seem to be changed. It's a psalm where it says, humanity was created a little lower than the angels. That's the way it comes across in some translations. Other translations, you might have phrases like God, but then there's something about ruling the animals and so forth, and it's very clear that it's directly from Genesis 1, 26, 28. Any place else?
Does Peter?
I don't know. I don't think so, unless he may, but I'm not, I don't think so.
You could take Romans 5.
Romans.
Paul speaks of the second Adam, Jesus, undoing the fall of the first Adam.
Okay. There's certainly this
5:16 and following.
Yeah, there's certainly this magnificent, you know, this very theologically pregnant passage in Romans about the first Adam and the second Adam. Whether I don't think in there there's any direct reference to humanity being created in God's image.
No.
There are a couple of any place else. It's one of the interesting things that this phrase, around which volumes and volumes have been written theologically, occurs very, very seldom. It occurs primarily only in Genesis 1, 26 and 28. It is repeated in Psalm 8, that is very directly a reference back to it. So it's curious why and how we should have an awful lot. Let me look at this list. All right. A theological baggage here. It means the spiritual, the soul, it's a resemblance, emotions, character, proper relationship without sin, imprint, ability to reason, creator, unending, free will, energy. Now, I'm not saying that doesn't mean these things aren't so, okay? I'm just trying to make the observation that a lot of thought and interpretation has gone into this passage, developing a pretty thorough doctrine on the basis of scriptural discussion that is extremely sparse. We see it here, created in the image of God, and it's just left. The Genesis writer doesn't explain it. These things are all inferences from Genesis 1, 26, 28. I mean, a lot of theology does that. Again, it doesn't mean that it's wrong, but theology sort of looks at what the Bible says and then sort of tries to reflect and say, okay, what did this mean? But none of these things are there. Should cause us to at least be curious. Now, let's go to the text. And it's interesting, those of you who were here on Saturday for Larry's Bible study, he is dealing with the same text. And how Jesus used it around the subject of marriage. So those of you who have been here for a few days, you're looking hard at just a couple of places and getting having a lot of helpful insights.
Okay, 26. Then God said, this is the New English Version. I don't like parts of it, but, you know, all translations have their limitations. Let us make man. Now, the word there is Adam, as Larry said, which really means humanity. Adama means the earth, the ground, the dust in Hebrew, and that's where Adam comes from. It doesn't mean, this isn't Adam as a person here. This is Adama. This is Adam from Adama, okay? So let us make man, let us make humanity. In our image and likeness. Curious the word our there, right? Okay, typically this is the Trinity. Well, there have been a lot of, you imagine what the, there was a significant comment about this passage by Jewish rabbis before the time of Christ. Most of their comment was around the word our. Okay, now we read that, we say, well, it must mean the Trinity. Well, think if you're reading this, even as the children of Israel were reading it, before they had any notion of the Trinity. It's just an interesting question, okay? Our image and likeness to rule the fish in the sea, the birds of heaven, the cattle, all the wild animals on earth, all the reptiles that crawl upon the earth. So God created humanity, Adam, in his own image. Now it's singular. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. The point Larry made, of course, was that male and female is part of being created in the image of God and the relationship between them. God blessed them and said, be fruitful and increase, fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish in the sea, the birds of heaven, and every living thing that moves upon the earth. Verse 29, God also said, I give you all plants that bear seed everywhere on earth, and every tree bearing fruit which yields seed. They shall be yours for food. All the green plants I give for food to the wild animals, to all the birds of heaven, to all the reptiles on earth, and every living creature. And it was so. God saw all he had made and said it was very good. This is, of course, about the sixth or seventh time God says everything was very good. Everything was very good long before we came on the scene. We tend to think that creation is good in relationship to what it does for us. But creation was pronounced good long before the sixth day, which means in God's eyes, creation is good in and of itself. Yes, ma'am.
This is the first time that he said that it was really good.
Very good. Well, that's true. The translation... I can't tell you for sure. There, in English translations, the other times, and there are in verse 3, in verse 13, in verse 18, in verse 21, God pronounces it good. Also 26... and then very good is used in the 31st verse. And I really can't tell you what the Hebrew is, except there obviously is a difference in emphasis, and that's worth noting. That's certainly worth noting.
I think it's interesting in verse 29 where he said, and God said, let us make man in our image.
Mm-hmm.
And then 27, so God created man in his
right.
image.
Right.
He's with somebody.
That's right. And as I say, that has, before the time of Christ and before the theology of the Christian church got working, that caused people a lot of bafflement and a lot of wondering. But at any rate, I want to get back to this image of God. It's said here three times, but what is said in reference to it? To the extent that this is explained at all in the text, what seems to be said, if anything?
Rulership.
Caretaker. Just a second here. We're getting something else. Rulership. lordship, caretaker. Now, how are you getting these things?
Talking about dominion.
The word dominion is used in some translations.
Responsibility.
Fruitfulness. Fruitfulness. There was another one I didn't hear. A man? Did someone else say something I didn't catch?
Dominion, I have given you these things.
Okay. Well, what's happening here? First, you told me image of God meant spirit, soul, resemblance, emotions, character, imprint, ability to reason, creator, etc., free will. Now, from the text, we're seeing to the extent that there's a relationship right in the text, rulership, lordship, caretaker, dominion, responsibility, fruitfulness, seems to be, in the text at least, an emphasis on, well, ruling of what?
Animal.
Creation. I just said, someone said animals, and someone said creation. Now tell me where it says ruling creation. Fill the earth and subdue it. The word earth there means, well, I'll tell you, means basically ground. This very important verse or phrase, subdue the earth. We say earth and we think of the whole world, right? But another meaning of earth is what?
Soil, right?
That also we also call soil. All right. In the Hebrew, that earth means that soil, the ground.
Is that the same word as the
Adam? It's a slightly different word, as a matter of fact. It's a slightly different word in Hebrew, but a word in Hebrew meaning the ground rather than meaning the whole world.
But you said that word that. Humanity was related.
Yes, from Adama, yes.
And that's not that word.
No, it's not that word. It's not that word. But it is another Hebrew word which is used, when it's used at other places, it refers to, you know, the stuff of the earth, the ground that's used,
for
you know,
tilling.
For tilling, basically. Now, would it make sense that here's a picture of life at the beginning of creation, and what's said is subdue the earth, meaning the ground, meaning till it. What comes right after subdue the earth?
Replenish.
What else?
Have dominion.
All right, verse 29. I give you every plant and what?
Plant yielding seed,
meaning what?
Grain.
Okay? meaning there are plants which yield seed, grain, for you to eat. And I give these to you so you can till the ground, so that you can have sustenance in order to feed yourself. In fact, how, in this picture of Genesis, how does humanity feed itself?
Vegetarian.
In case you didn't realize that, the only way in which humanity feeds itself here, in this picture, so far, is from the plants that bear seed, meaning from grains and fruits, we certainly say. Yes, sir. It's a good question, and I don't want to
I don't want to skirt it, but it partly gets us into a whole another discussion. But nevertheless, when, for instance, the children of Israel talk about the land which I have given you, all right, I'm giving you this land, and the word frequently used there, not exclusively, is Eretz, all right? And by giving the land, what was meant is, here is the land upon which you can settle. You no longer have to be a wandering people. You've been in the wilderness now for 400 years, not 40 years, for 40 years. Now you can settle and on a land that you can till and cultivate, okay? There is a wider discussion behind that because there are even some broader connotations. But it's not, when we say the word earth and think of the globe, all right? Now, it's not that. It's a place where you settle and till. And I'm glad you brought it up because it helps elaborate it more. All right. These are ruling over in order, the picture that we're getting here, in order for fruitfulness, but how is this related to image of God? Why is the term image of God then used?
Well, isn't God everywhere and in everything?
All right, God's everywhere and in everything.
He's the caretaker and ruler and the one that makes it fruitful.
He's the caretaker. He's the one that makes it fruitful. When you say the word image, when we just use that word in what are various what comes to mind when you think of an image?
Reflection.
Reflection.
Like in a mirror.
Likeness in a mirror. Okay. What else?
Form.
Form. What do you mean by form?
Similarity.
Shape.
Shape. Think in the Old Testament, this word image is used other times. Can you think of other places where the Old Testament talks about images of any kind? Graven images, idols. All right. Now maybe we're getting somewhere.
But it's physical matter.
Mm-hmm. When... we can kind of remember what we started with here now, okay? In this time, as in many times through history, when there was a king who ruled over a wide territory, all right? And the king or the ruler would have a capital here, but ruled all this territory. It was hard to get around. They didn't have telecommunications and stuff like that. But the king wanted the people down here to know that this area was ruled by the king here. So what would the king do?
He sent an ambassador.
He would send an ambassador. All right, I think you're getting ahead of it, but you're absolutely right. He might send an ambassador to sort of be there as the king's representative. An image of himself. He might erect a statue, right? Excuse my art, I'm not Rudy Wendelin. He might erect a statue as an image of himself in order to say, this territory is mine. You're under my rulership here. I'm the one that's in charge. In fact, that was a common practice in Old Testament times. And when we read humanity being created in the image of God, the most likely meaning that it had initially to the people who heard it was exactly this kind of meaning. They thought of the king in a distant country who would put an image in order to signify that king's rule in a territory where the king couldn't be physically present. Don't take my word for it. It's any theologian who has a German name means that they must know more than we do.
the famous Old Testament scholar Gerhard von Rad, that some of you have probably heard of, but he, commenting on this passage, and he's not unique at all, but he, I think, was the first one who began to see this picture more recently. Just, this is what he says, just as powerful earthly kings, to indicate their claim to dominion, erect an image of themselves in provinces of their empire where they do not personally appear, so humanity is placed upon the earth in God's image as God's sovereign emblem. He is really only God's representative, summoned to maintain and enforce God's claim to dominion over the earth. Now, isn't that interesting? Being in God's image meant more than likely to the people who first heard this and to those who wrote it, none of these things that we had on the left-hand side of the board, but rather the sense that humanity was put here in order to carry out God's rulership, to uphold God's order, to carry forth God's purposes. We were in the image of God, sort of like a statue, but in fact we're alive. We're here to relate to the earth as God's emissary, as God's emblem, to carry out what God wants, what God intends, to uphold God's order. There's another, he also happens to be a German, but wrote a book that was just recently translated called World and Environment. His name is Odell Steck, S-T-E-C-K, Steck, we'd say. Very provocative book. Very heavy theologically in the translation. It reads in English as though it were German, you know, with word sentences that are paragraphs long. I want to just read you one part because he really has done some good biblical work, and he's talking specifically about Genesis 1:26-28. Certainly, this passage does not give humanity the right of autonomous and autocratic disposal over the animal world, and he's saying the animal world because the specific reference outside of the one phrase subdue the earth, the specific reference is to all the animals. Over the animal world for his own self-chosen purposes detached from God. Humanity rules in this office as God's image, that is, as God's steward in the world, which God created for permanence. Any exercise of rule on the part of humanity prompted by independent purposes, arrived at apart from God, or in deliberate separation from God, and leading to the damage or even destruction of the foundations of animal life, or we could say the foundations of life on earth, would be totally contrary to the intentions of what this passage has to say. Frequently, we've interpreted, and maybe not so much we, but others in the culture, have interpreted this passage, have dominion, rule, subdue it, and so forth, as basically saying, here the Bible says we can do with this what we want. And why can we spend $5 million to go up on a hillside and take out $100 million worth of copper and leave tailings with arsenic and all sorts of other stuff in it? Because we're supposed to have control and just do with the world. It's here for that purpose. It's here for us to control it. All right? The biblical picture, even here in Genesis 1:26-28, is really quite different. We're here to act as God's representatives, to uphold the order, the purpose, what the Bible quickly refers to as shalom. God's intention for the whole creation of harmony and fruitfulness. We're here to uphold that for the sake of God and, of course, for one another. And not only for one another, but for the sake of all life. Another summary. If we want to find a formula for what the writer's intention in Genesis 1:26-28 is it can be best represented by saying that the world is created by God for the sake of all life. Now, I want to quickly, before our time is over, I'm going to skip over a passage that many of you, when you've thought about these things, have probably heard of, Genesis 2:15, which also discusses the same theme, but talks about earthkeeping, placed on the earth to till and care for it. All right, so even there in the second chapter of Genesis, you get a slightly different emphasis than you do in the first, but actually I think the material we've been dealing with here in the first chapter is even, in my mind, is probably more important. But what happens? What happens? The story we know doesn't end here. The third chapter. What is defined as the heart of sin?
Wanting to be like God.
Now, what in the world? What in the world?
We're like God, aren't we?
Oh, how can being like God suddenly mean, well, if we think image of God means resemblance, then it doesn't make much sense to say sin means being like God, does it? When you think about it. But if image of God means acting as God's representative to carry forth God's purposes, then how does that differ from being like God?
Take his place.
Take God's place. Yes, sir.
It's a challenge to God's rulership. It's like a revolution and attempt to overthrow it.
A revolution and attempt to overthrow. All right. Think back. Oh, I just erased it. But think back to here. You've got a ruler, and you've got someone here who's in God's image to carry out God's purposes. Suddenly these people say what? Yeah, why can't we make these decisions?
That's what's the trouble in Central America now.
Okay, you mentioned, well, I don't know if that's what the trouble is, but what you mentioned, Central America, is an excellent example. An excellent example.
And the greed at the top.
The greed at the top? Okay, well, I think now I think I understand you better. I think that is what the trouble is. When you read about even a revolution or a coup d'etat, let's say, what happens? The people who were the colonels, or more than that, the people who were the peasants, who were just carrying out these rules. Let's use the example of sort of a military coup. It often doesn't make things better, but let's say you've got a couple of generals at top and you've got a couple of colonels, and they've been doing everything the generals want, and they finally say, hey, I want to be the general. Okay, let me get together a few battalions and go overthrow the general. Now I'm going to be the general. All right, well, and now that's the picture here of what being like God means. It means I'm going to take control over what?
The earth.
Over the creation. And what? Over what is the first sin as we understand it? I mean, what's it directed towards?
Knowledge.
Yeah, but what specifically? What?
Knowledge of good and evil.
Over the garden.
The garden. The tree. I want this. Well, maybe I can't have this tree. So what if you've given me everything? Now, I mean, I'm going to set the rules. I'm going to use what I want to use for my own purposes. I'm going to use it for myself. I'm going to decide how creation's going to be used. I'm going to have the power to exercise the way I see it for my purposes, to fulfill my needs, to get myself satisfied. So the picture of sin around the impulse to be like God. We referred briefly to this sort of triangle on Saturday night too. But if we think about God in humanity and then the rest of creation, the non-human creation over here, of which humanity is of course a part, but the alienation between humanity and God is, and you can say also produces, you could almost say is caused by, is certainly related to the alienation between humanity and the rest of creation. You see that? Follow it further very quickly in the scripture. You have to go no longer than the next chapter than to read about how what's referred to as the curse means that there's an alienation between Adam and the ground, and that becomes even worse with Cain. Cain kills Abel, and the judgment pronounced on Cain in chapter 4 now, we're moving quickly. The Lord said to Cain, "Where is your brother Abel?" Cain answered, "I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper?" The word keeper, shamar, is the same word used in Genesis 2:15 when humanity is placed in the garden to till and to keep the whole creation. All right, humanity is there to keep the whole creation, and now suddenly we're only one generation. And suddenly Cain is saying, "Well, am I supposed to keep my own brother?" I mean, that's how far things have deteriorated already, right? Then the Lord answered, "What have you done? Hark, your brother's blood that has been shed is crying out to me from the ground. Now you are accursed and banished from the ground, which has opened its mouth wide to receive your brother's blood, which you have shed. When you till the ground, it will no longer yield you its wealth. You shall be a vagrant and wanderer on the earth." Cain said, "My punishment is heavier than I can bear." On a little further, "I shall be a vagrant and wanderer on the earth." There's a thing about a mark on Cain. And then it says, Cain went out from the Lord's presence and settled in the land of Nod, which means the land of wanderings. And in verse 17, by the way, next time we find Cain, he's building a city, which doesn't give us the best, most hopeful grounds for understanding the root of urban life. But it's interesting that the first time even city appears in the Bible, it appears as a mark of alienation from the earth. Now, it doesn't mean that cities aren't also redeemed, because by the time we get to Revelation, Jerusalem is a new city, right? But it is interesting to note here, the alienation from humanity produces an alienation from creation. And we can even work it in reverse. And we can say alienation from creation produces an alienation from God. And we can then say that humanity's effort in treating creation as a thing which it owns, which humanity owns, is to try to drive creation away from God. To try to treat it as though it were a thing of itself. To secularize it. To destroy its relationship to God. Now, we have only 5 minutes, and I hate to leave us on this pessimistic note, because the Bible doesn't leave it here. It doesn't leave it here even in Genesis. I want to ask you real quickly, and we'll pick this up tomorrow for those who will still be with us. Covenant. What? Who's involved in God's covenant?
Abraham.
Abraham. And what's the covenant with?
Abraham and his descendants.
Abraham and his descendants. Which means it's covenants between God and the descendants of Abraham. Anyone else?
Does they give him land?
Well, there is some reference to land in there, actually. There is a little reference to Eretz that's there.
What does covenant mean?
An agreement.
Promise.
Promise, a little stronger than agreement, really. Promise, pledge,
Oath. Contract, yes, but even stronger than what we would think of as a legal contract. Nevertheless, I want to...
It was initiated by God rather than...
Initiated by God, yes.
It's a three-sided contract.
A three-sided contract, Joan says.
More like a...
Between...
Between God...
Yes.
And his descendants.
Between God and his descendants?
Yes. Therefore, it cannot be broken unless all three are together.
Okay. My friends, you've all been the product of typical theological education. I want you, how many of you are going to be in the village tomorrow? Most of you? Okay. I want you to go read Genesis 8 and Genesis 9. All right? And for those of you who aren't here, I'll just say the answers that you've heard are all wrong. It's the Bible. Covenant appears for the first time not with Abraham.
Noah.
Yeah. The first covenant is with Noah. And what is the covenant with?
You will no longer destroy the earth by water.
The covenant is with God and humanity and all the creation. And because I suppose people didn't think they'd get the point, it's repeated 6 times. All right, just to say that given this break between God and humanity and the creation, even before the Genesis account of creation ends, meaning even by the time you get to Noah, the picture is of God taking the initiative to reestablish this harmony, to reestablish the relationship between God, the people of God, and all the creation. That initiative is culminated in the person of Jesus Christ, which is one reason why you have a lot of New Testament scriptures that speak in the same vein. And one reason why the only New Testament scripture that refers specifically to the image of God, to this passage, which is in Hebrews 2, says, in fact, maybe I could just squeeze it in, so that you, at least those of you who are leaving, at least get the picture. Hebrews 2, beginning with verse 5, "For it is not to the angels that he subjected the world to come," which is our theme, but there is somewhere a solemn assurance which runs, a writer of Hebrews didn't know where it was, but it's in Psalm 8. "What is man that thou rememberest him, or the son of man that thou dost regard him? Thou didst make him for a short while a little lower than the angels, dost crown him with glory and honor. Thou dost put all things in subjection beneath his feet. For in subjecting all things to him, he left nothing that is not subject. But, in fact, we do not see all things in subjection to man." Now, the word subjection here doesn't mean exploit and rule over. It means, the way in which this is used here, it means a harmonious relationship. It means a right kind of relationship. The same way when it talks about all things being subject to Christ. All things... being in a right and restored relationship. And the writer of Hebrews say, well, in fact, we don't see this. It's very obvious we don't see this. However, in Jesus, we do see one who for a short while was made lower than the angels, now crowned with glory and honor because he suffered death, so that by God's gracious will he should stand for all. It is clearly fitting that God, for whom and through whom all things exist, should bring many children of God to glory and make the leader who delivers them perfect through suffering. The first chapter of Hebrews, which begins this theme, says, "But in the final age he has spoken to us in the Son, whom he has made heir to the whole universe, through whom he created all orders of existence, the Son who is the effulgence of God's splendor and the stamp of God's very being, and sustains the universe by his word of power." In Jesus, the image of God is restored, meaning in Jesus we see one who in fact has come as one to carry out God's intention of ruling over, in the best sense of that term, over all the creation, and in bringing all the creation back into relationship to God. So that while humanity seemed to fail in its attempt to serve in the image of God because it wanted to be the one in control, wanted to exert its own will, in Jesus, the one who does the Father's perfect will, this image of God is restored, and through Jesus, the people who know Jesus' life, through Jesus, this whole relationship can be restored in our experience. We too, being children of God, can be those who restore the creation into relationship to ourselves and into relationship to God through Christ, who is the creator of all. We're going to have more time to deal with those themes that I've just touched at the end in the next 2 days, but I wanted to give you at least a capsule. Any questions before the bell rings?
Just one comment.
Yes.
When you say Jesus restores the image, at the Great Judgment Day, Jesus will say we will recognize him, the least of these, our brothers. Mm-hmm. So it's not only that we have the image ourselves of who is restored in us as representatives of God, mm-hmm. but we see in every other person, and I think there's a social dimension, that we need to emphasize that in each child of God, we also see Christ.
Right.
So this gives us a whole new concept of relationship to one another, that the image we see in other people. And Jesus will remind us of that on judgment.
More than that, and I think Joan is going to have a session this week on that passage, Matthew 25. What is set out, if you remember, is blessing and curse, right? And it is very similar to the theme that you see emerging at the beginning in Genesis, creation being blessed when lived in harmony with God, creation being cursed through rebellion from God. And what Genesis is really trying to say at the outset is not that everything is going to go downhill, but rather is that we have before us these two possibilities, the possibilities of blessing or curse, possibilities which we can always choose anew in responding to God. And in fact, I think Matthew, part of the meaning of Matthew 25 is in fact continuing that very vision of blessing or curse depending upon how we respond in relationship, not just to God, but to God's whole creation. And all the needs that are mentioned amongst the least of these, my brethren, what's being done? They're given food and water and shelter. You see, creation is being restored as a gift. Okay.
You know something? That the more and more I learn about the Bible, the less and less I know.